Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Full Service Radio.
Welcome to the Altesa Server Experience. We are live from the Line Hotel. I am your host, Violeta Edelman, owner of the Altesa Gelato here in Washington, D.C. And I'm here with my partner,
Rob Duncan, also owner of Dolcezza Gelato here in D.C.
Yeah, we're here today with Amy Brandwine, chef and owner of Centralina. And Amy, Rob and I have known you for a while, but I feel like lately you've been on fire. You've been nominated for the second time for Best Chef in the Mid-Atlantic.
It's about fucking time, Amy. You've been around for long enough. They finally recognize, right? So it's now bending it your way.
Thank you.
Anyway, as I was saying, you've been nominated for the second time for Best Chef in the Mid-Atlantic by the James Beard Foundation, which is a huge deal. You just won Chef of the Year at the Rami Awards here in D.C. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And of course, this is due to your incredible cooking, but also you're out there representing a rare breed, a woman, chef and restaurant owner in a very male-dominated industry here in Washington, D.C., and that alone is getting a lot of attention as well. So thank you for being here. There's a lot to talk about.
I'm so excited. Thank you.
So I want to go back to the beginnings, and you've been very vocal and not afraid to discuss, you know, difficult topics, and such as, you know, rising as a female chef in an all-male kitchen. And you've discussed this in the past, so how was your experience, and what did you have to do for those dudes to listen to you?
Well, you know, when I started thinking about changing careers, I had no idea what I was getting into. So I quit my job. I went to culinary school, and I ended up in Roberta Donna's kitchen at Galileo. I didn't end up there, actually. I wanted to work there. And so I found myself entering this space where it was just like, welcome to Italy, you know? Just everybody was speaking Italian. You know, nobody was anything I had ever seen before in my life. And so it was like a complete culture immersion and shock. And then learning kind of how to work in the kitchen. And you know, I started out, you know, I asked them for a job in the line because I was hoping to be like a cook, you know. And they said, well, we have pastry or we have garmage. And then they said, well, garmage is actually taken, so it has to be pastry. And I was like, okay, I'll do it, you know. And then I worked, you know, I ended up moving on to the grill and ended up working every station. But, you know, it was really challenging. I wasn't sure, like I was trying to learn how to cook first, and then there just weren't any women that were cooking, like they, you know, they weren't any people on the hotline. So you know, people were sort of looking at me and kind of like kind of friendly but kind of like harassing me, or I should say hazing is the better word, you know, constantly ribbing me. And you know, so it's not something you can say is like outright offensive, but it just was very hard to like just
it was
keep.
Probably the ambient, the environment, right, as far as the way that maybe women were looked upon. And this was in 2000?
Yeah, 2000. Wow. So it was a long time ago. And you know,
before hashtags.
Yeah, before you
before
know
me too,
before it was really yeah. popular to be a woman chef. So
right.
You know, it wasn't a positive attribute at that time, so it was really sort of like, do you really want to do this? Like, who are you and why are you doing this? And you know, I just love to cook, and so I sort of, you know, there was this other part of the Italian culture there that was very like used to having women in the kitchen and love the women's touch and like the way
but
that
it's
women.
It's always the mother, isn't it?
Right. It's always the mom.
But it's yeah. so funny, because really, if any of us go back, it's like, who are the best cooks ever in the, our lives and many other, it's our grandmas, you know?
Right.
That's where the kitchen, as far as, and they're the best cooks, but now because it's industry of food and restaurants, it's now
been
the male-dominated world, but really the best cooks ever is everybody's grandma.
Right, so there's like sort of this feminine sensibility that goes, I think, along with cooking Italian, whereas you're using super fresh ingredients, you're trying to cook from the soul, or you just do cook from the soul, and really, like, it's sort of like you're, like, just putting your heart out on a plate. So I think those are more feminine, you know, type of attributes, but when it gets to coming, you know, when you're cooking in the kitchen for 200 people and you're like, you know, you're cooking veal chops or you're, you know, slinging tons
fires
of pasta.
And knives.
Pasta, yeah, and then there's knives and all this thing and people are, you know, really macho and then things get a little ugly, you know. So I worked my way up in that kitchen and I was a saucier, which was sort of like the last step before a sous chef, you know, and like that was really something because I was like, in saucier, you're like leading the line, you know, and I remember they put me on for a Saturday night, all eyes on me. Can I hold this kitchen together?
Because was that the Laboratorio del Galileo? No,
that was the main kitchen.
The
main kitchen. So, and then I did some work in the Laboratorio too, but it was really intense and just really tough. And I will say that, you know, most of the most unpleasant things that happened in that particular kitchen was not from Italian men. It was mostly from American guys.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so.
Huh. I would just think like the machismo that's in Latin culture and, you know, the Italian.
You would
Italian.
Think so, yeah.
But I guess also they have, I mean, it's a high culture. They also know how to treat women, too, maybe a little bit more.
Yeah,
I don't know if more in Americans.
So what did you have to do? I mean, I know that there's double standards for everything. So if you yell and get angry, you're not perceived the same way as the male chef who is supposed to yell and get angry, right?
Right.
So how did you manage those?
Did you yell back?
Or no, well, you were leading the line.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, I just tried to. I had to be very good at my job first of all. You know, I was just. If I was not extremely competent, then I would have never had a chance there. But beyond that, I really had to swallow a lot of it. I mean, I have to say I wasn't like, you know, the first one to be like the trailblazer in that kitchen being like, don't talk to me like that, F you, or anything like that. Like, that wasn't what was happening. I was swallowing a lot of BS while I was trying to learn how to cook and do my job. And then eventually there were moments where things got heated and things got ugly, or they were talking in Italian, and sometimes they were talking about me, and I realized, I learned Italian and I learned Spanish in that kitchen, but I realized that I really had to learn Italian because, you know, some people were just basically, you know, throwing me under the bus, and I didn't even understand because I couldn't understand what they were saying. So there were these moments where, like, you know, the chef would come in and, you know, he'd say, well, who did this? Or, you know, like, and then they would, you know, try to figure out a way to, like, blame everybody else except them. Or there was other times where, you know, Chef Roberto would say, well, this is beautiful. Who did this? And one time I said, I did. And then he looked at me and that's when he really, everybody understood that I now understand what you're saying. So
it's the best way to learn a language. When I lived in Brazil and Argentina, that's always what I said. Is like, I had to learn the language so I could defend myself.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's kind of the same thing in the kitchen. If you don't know what they're saying, then you're at their mercy.
Right, yeah. So, and you know, there's just these certain times where the chips came down, and those were times when I spoke up, especially when it was something about food or things not being prepared the way that they were supposed to be according to standard, you know. I would just speak to the chef and say, like, you know, I just have to lay down the gauntlet. Like, I care about what I'm doing. I care about what you're doing. This is not being done correctly. And I would just get hot in my face and be like, you know, this is not right. Like, either you're going to stand up you're going to realize what's happening to this particular moment and you're going to stand up for it, or, you know, I'm going to have to figure out that this is really not going to work for me. You know what I mean?
How did they respond to when that happened, when you kind of laid down the law?
They were definitely completely, like, positively responding. So they would address the situation, but a lot of things were thrown under the rug. And so I was sort of like, my merit started to come to the top because I was standing up for what was right and what the food and the integrity of the food, which is what I really, truly, I loved about cooking there and what I still carry on with me. So I think that's the thing. You have to stand by your principles.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. For sure. That's what defines you still, and that's what defines your cooking and the place that you created later on. But I want to just tell our listeners who Roberto Donna is. A lot of people know him here in D.C., and he's a celebrity chef, James Beard Award winner, one-time chief of a restaurant empire here in D.C. In the 2000s, he was the god of D.C.
It was him, Michelle
fine
Richard.
Dining.
Very
he also
people.
Ended
Kim
up pleading guilty to embezzlement for withholding meal taxes. But
he never paid us when we delivered gallons of gelato to his restaurant. The other restaurant after Galileo, what was it called? That was in
Babo.
Babo.
Yeah.
But I'm not interested in discussing Roberto Donna. I want to talk about your experience as a woman in the kitchen.
Back.
So you ended up making it to executive chef.
Yep.
Was it more difficult to get promoted as a woman?
Yeah. I mean, there was multiple people that were trying to bring me down. I mean, literally, just
you're a tough cookie, girl.
Take me out. Yeah, I mean, it was rough, and it was extremely ugly situation. So, but I ended up becoming chef, and and I'm still standing here talking about it, and it was a great experience overall. But there's a lot of swallowing your pride that I think we don't talk about. Now I get a mic, and I get to talk about what it's like. But back then there was no mic and nobody gave a shit. So
yeah. And so many girls are not able to move forward, the way that you did. We had someone working for us years ago that was working for this very well-known chef here, and she was a young girl, and she came back to work crying because the chef kept saying this is shit and throwing whatever meal she had made to the floor, and she had to pick up the pieces, and she stopped working. She stopped cooking because she couldn't.
Right.
She wasn't strong enough.
Right.
To continue, and so there is all these girls out there, and now it's changing, but there were all these girls that didn't make it.
Right.
It's kind of tragic
in
a way.
So tell me this. Where do you attribute your toughness? Where did you get your hardness from? Being
your
in
parents?
There and like standing strong and taking it. Where does that
come
from?
Well, I mean, quite frankly, my parents were divorced at six. So, my mom was a single mom, and I had a brother, and my mom was like just really trying to make it work, and we didn't come.
Where did you grow up?
In Arlington. So we did.
You're local.
Yeah, I'm a local. So
yeah.
Like, awesome. I saw her, it was a struggle back in the 70s. Back in the 70s, women really weren't, doing this type of thing. Like, she was working on Capitol Hill and going to work every day and then coming home, and sometimes we'd have fried chicken, or we would have, it wasn't this glamorous thing. So I really saw, I was just sort of, a little bit of hardship and realized at a very young age that I was going to have to sort of, I felt like I had to fend for myself. Not that I didn't have supportive parents, but
single parent. Oh,
yeah.
Man, that is tough.
But it's funny, when we think about our kids and looking back at, the hardships that we went through and how that informs your character,
yeah.
And it ends up being a good thing.
Yeah.
It's not a bad thing.
Yeah.
It can
end up being a good thing. A lot of it depends on how it all goes. Sometimes the hardships ruin somebody. The other times they make
them
stronger.
I don't know what I attribute this thing that I have that keeps me going. I'm very resilient. I mean, extremely resilient. And I just think it just has to do with sort of like that was probably part of it. And I saw, that I was going to have to pave my way. I spent a good amount of my childhood after school. I was a latchkey kid. So I spent some of my time cooking and then otherwise, dealing with my older brother. I love him, but he was a real pain.
I think children of the 70s and 80s here were all latchkey kids. So
you think,
sense.
Yeah, so that,
a lot of us.
Yeah, that was kind of the thing. And I had to put myself through school, through college. I had like three jobs in college. And then when I got out of school, the same. So I was really like every single thing that happened to me was sort of like, you have to do this. You have to
Work hard.
You have to work hard. How are you going to survive? That was really, I think, a lot of it. So
yeah.
And then after you spend some time with Roberto Donna, you work for the Ritz-Carlton, and once again there were zero women running kitchens for them, right?
Yeah.
So that was another
You're over in Pentagon City, is that the that's so funny now going back and listening to I remember because I had talked to you over there also when you were back in the Ritz-Carlton. And we did some business with the Ritz-Carlton's. Well, I mean, we delivered gelato to the all the Ritz-Carlton's. yeah, they paid us.
Well, that's great. I mean, yeah, that was just a tough experience for me. I realized that I didn't identify myself as a creative person. My brother's an artist, but I didn't necessarily think that I was creative. I was a chef, but I didn't think I was creative until I realized...
Inside the corporate structure.
How creative you were.
How creative I was. And I was
because
like,
everyone else.
It was a good experience for me because I realized like I don't feel comfortable. And I need to feel comfortable. So it took me a while to get to that point.
You know, I remember the when the Ritz-Carlton on M Street here came and Eric Repair opened up, what is it called? Table or something Bistro?
West End Bistro.
God,
that
seems like so long ago, doesn't it? It was, though. And I remember the guys that came. It was Robert Berry, Ricky King, old, you know, Charleston, Valdea Cooks with Boobin, R.J. Cooper. And then they had this guy, Leo Marino, come down from New York.
I met him, who
was working with Eric Repair at Le Bernardin.
Yeah.
And it was a matter of 2 to 3 months, and they all got run out of the kitchen because they refused to go the Ritz-Carlton way. And they were hardcore. They were in the farmer's markets with us, buying all the pork from Bev and Eco Friendly and all the stuff. And we went and we did gelato for them, and the menu and the food that they were cooking was unbelievable, but they got run out because they did not fit the fabric of the corporate of the Ritz-Carlton.
Yeah, I mean, I was the only woman that I could see for miles. I mean, in a position of a chef, and then Eric Repair hired a female chef at the Arts Hotel or in Philadelphia.
The Ritz-Carlton there. I stayed there where that was Carol, Jenny Carol. Yeah. Way after. Was it, what's it? It's not Jenny, is it? Carol?
I'm not
Yeah,
sure.
Jennifer Carol.
Jen Carol, totally. At Table 10 or something like that.
Yeah, it was...
something 10.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's doing really well now, apparently.
So then you open another Italian restaurant, Casa Nonna, and that closed pretty quickly. And then after that, you were like, okay, I'm going to open my own place, right? So talk to me about
Casa
the process
Nonna,
of...
that was Connecticut, south of DuPont.
Talk to me about the process of being done, you know, working for others.
Talk about what?
The process of just, I'm done working for others. I'm going to create my own... I'm going to follow my vision and open my own restaurant.
Yeah, so, you know, Casa Nonna looked like it was going to close. I had an idea. It was just things weren't going well. And I didn't, I mean.
That was BLT?
Yeah, BLT Restaurant Group. Yeah. So I was just getting some smoke signals that weren't positive. So it was more like a fire. Yeah. So I just, you know, said, well, you know, I've put so much work into all these restaurants, meaning like I was laying down the infrastructure, whether it was for, you know, my first chef or these companies. And I opened a restaurant, two restaurants for BLT Restaurant Group, and, you know, put myself out there. And, you know, when you...
And opening a restaurant is brutal.
It's brutal. It's the worst. It's the worst.
Yes.
I mean, I had opened...
The first one or the 10th one?
It's
a nightmare.
It's chaos
and it's
with
horrible.
With multiple parties.
Right, and you don't know what's going to happen until you open the doors, and you don't know what the reception's going to be like until the people come in.
What it would be is always different from the reality. So then you have to, you know, building out and constructing a restaurant, and when you open, then begins another phase that's different as far as working out how to maximize or run a restaurant.
Right, and you don't really know what it's going to look like until it's there. And so there's this, you know, you can sign on to projects and think like, oh, this sounds good. Like, you know, when I signed on with BLT, it was the recession. There was the huge recession of, 2010?
2008 to 2010.
That was like very bleak times, you know, so there was really no opportunities anywhere. And I thought this was going to be a great opportunity. And I learned a lot. But in terms of like what it took for me to say I've had enough, you know, I mean, I quite frankly was out of a job. 6 months before, I was getting these smoke signals, and I said, well, you know, I'm really tired, first of all. Like, I'm not 20 years old. Like, I've opened five or six restaurants in the last 5 or 6 years.
Ooh.
And I had been with Roberta for maybe 8 or 9 years But I had been bouncing around from place to place, meaning like these experiences was like I had like 8 years and then I had two and then two. And then I was just like, this is crazy. 6 years of three different restaurants is too much. And not when you're the face of the restaurant, you know, when you're like, yes, this is me. Hi, public. Like, I'm opening this restaurant. And then all the media comes out and all that stuff. And you're like, you know, placing your chips down. And then you're like, all of a sudden, you know, wow, I just opened two restaurants and it looks like I'm going to be out of a job soon. So I was like, this is not the recipe for success. Like, I need to either open my own place or, unfortunately, think about doing something else. Maybe not doing this anymore because this is not healthy, you know. So
you considered walking away from the kitchen altogether?
I did. If I thought, like, if I couldn't get this restaurant off the ground, I just felt like, you know, I can't do this anymore, you know. You know, it was heartbreaking.
Yeah.
I mean, I was heartbroken after many of those segments.
Yeah.
It was very heartbreaking. And I felt like just sort of like completely decimated after, some of these experiences. So, I set up, you know, I just said, this is it, you know, like you obviously know how to cook, you know how to open restaurants. You've done it so successfully for all these different people, you know, whether the concept was originally, if it ended up the way it was supposed to, is not a reflection on you. It's a reflection on the fact that, like, no one really was like, maybe people weren't paying attention to what you had to offer. You're the face of the restaurant, but, you know, it's not really suiting you. And I was thinking, like, I can't put myself in a box. Like, I can't make a what do they call it, those dishes, the iconic dish. I can't create an iconic dish for you for your opening, because it has to evolve. Like, I can't just make, like, you know, Ritz-Carlton is fun,
just keep following the same recipe
over and over. Well, they want you to create this thing, you know, and I'm like,
to what's your like exact plan and opening menu?
No,
and
I mean, like,
thing?
The dish, they want this iconic dish, like, this is the dish that all the press is going to talk about and things like that. And I'm like, I can't do that. Like, so I realized, like, I spiritually can't create this like this. So, and it doesn't suit me. And so I just decided that I was going to try to do this. And then if I couldn't launch my own restaurant, I was going to try to figure out, maybe my thoughts were like, I'll cook or I'll do something in the field. Maybe it was photography, or I like to write, or maybe something like that. But I wasn't going to keep using my persona to launch these restaurants and then not achieve any kind of meritable success, you know.
So from that point of like thinking about going and taking photos of food and stuff like that, how did Centralina then open up?
Well, I, you know, I wrote my business plan after I got off work and on my days off, and then one of my customers is a lawyer, and he happened to have business formation practice, basically. So I had a lot of resources at my fingertips once I started reaching out to people and saying, like, I need some help. And a lot of people helped me kind of gather networks to say, hey, this woman's interested in starting a restaurant. What do you think? And connecting me with people. And then I had to follow up every single time with every single person. And I had my business plan done. And then I had to pitch every single person over and over again. And,
you talk about this. I mean, I've read about it. You know, when you talk about the not so glamorous aspects of the business, and you always say fundraising for Centralina took me 4 years.
Yeah.
So this is what you're talking about right now.
Yeah.
And people were like, oh, a woman running a restaurant, owning a restaurant.
4 years for real?
I don't know if I'm going to invest, or I don't know if the bank is going to give me the loan, because there is no other women own restaurants. And
right.
There is no other examples of success.
Yeah.
So you were, again, a pioneer fighting against the waves.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the interesting things is, like, I think a lot of chefs, they have people that are doing this for them. And, you know, I had approached some of those people, and, you know, they were recommending me, like, hey, why don't you talk to this person? And I did. And then they would say, oh, well, you know, I'm working with this chef. Do you want to work for him? And I said, well, I'm not really, I've done that before. I'm not interested in doing that. I really want to start my own restaurant. So, it was obvious to me that there were some doors that were not open, like available to me in the way that there might have been available to other people. And then so it became very clear that I was not going to find anybody like
your angel investors. I wasn't that were waiting to find
I wasn't going to find the money man that was going to make all these connections happen for me. I had to do it one at a time. And so, you know, it was just, you know, really hard. And like, I learned how to fundraise. Like, you know, one of my colleagues was a political fundraiser, and she coached me. You know, she didn't raise the money for me, but she coached me. Like, you know, I wasn't even comfortable, you know, if people said, okay, well, I'll get back to you, I was not comfortable saying, okay, when?
Right.
I need an answer by X date.
Right.
You know, and then that was really hard. And then I had people say, oh, well, why do you need a minimum of this? You know, I need, how about half of that? And I'm like, well, I'm never going to raise anything if I let everybody contribute such a small amount of money. So, you know, I had like a lot of people, you know, I met with people. Some people were just kind of like, oh, yeah, you did great work. You did great work. I'll get back to you, and then never get back to you. And then it's hard not to be. It's hard not to take it
personally.
Yeah.
I didn't take it personally. It's hard not to be sort of demoralized and wonder, like, I've been working on this for a couple of years. How am I have, you know, I have a pending LOI. I have a lease I'm trying to close on. And, you know, I needed a minimum of X amount of money before I could close on my lease. And then there was the bank loan. And it's like, it was just
thin skin for a business owner or restaurant cook. You can't have that because, I mean, especially doing it. Yeah.
We're talking about what happened to a woman,
but also
a couple, some years ago, not that long ago, because things have changed now. For the first time, there are funds for women, and women are getting together and helping each other. But things were not this way in like 2010, 11, 12.
But and also just the thing is, like, it's so resonant with us as far as like it's always like when doing this, opening up your restaurant, fundraising, design of the restaurant, and it's like the. You have to, you're on your own.
Right.
You are on your own.
Right.
No matter what help, support, advice.
Correct.
You are the ones making every single decision about your future space and where you're going to cook, what you're going to cook, how you're going to get the money to be able to build the rest. It's hardcore, but it is hardcore. But for the ones that do it and actually get out alive kind of thing, the wealth of knowledge and experience, not from a book, not from a best friend, not from an education, a diploma whatsoever, but from your own experience of getting into this thing where you're completely vulnerable, insecure about it, what you learn about the process and then can become such a good teacher and helper for all the others. You know, it's really it's strong, and it's the same process that we've been through since 2004 with Dolcezza. And it's, you know, as you know now, since we're leaning and open up Piccolina, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like it's always... It's the same thing over and over and over.
Yeah, I mean,
but at different levels.
Yeah,
as far as going,
I mean,
into a new project and trying to figure it out.
Well, I don't think
it's
the same thing. Now Amy's recognized.
It's the same process of opening and
doing
it on your own.
Yeah, but I'm sure now it's easier to fund.
It's at a different level. I mean, obviously, if you have a restaurant that you can take an investor into, whatever, to show it, but it's this thing of like you're always reinventing yourself.
No,
we're starting all over
again.
That's a good
point. I didn't have any, there was no concrete anything to point to.
Exactly.
It was like, I have an idea. This is my idea on paper. Here are my projections. Like, there was nothing to point to except myself in this meeting with this other person. And so now I have something to point to. I have a track record of success, meaning my own. But at that time, there was nothing to say that this was going to work out for me. Plus, like, you know, at that time, like, women chefs were not getting any recognition or any kind of serious, you know, accolades, meaning, like, the reviews weren't coming so easy for me, no matter what kind of food I put out. And, you know, I know the food was good because it's the same, some of the same things that I'm doing. I've
done
Roberto
Donna was getting accolades for.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was, you know, he is an amazing chef, but I had created a lot of things back then that I'm still utilizing in my current restaurant. Now there's a perception, right? And then when the perception changes, everybody views that product through a different lens. And so I was trying to get people to evaluate my food in a certain way. It was a little bit I felt it was a little bit hard to get people to take me seriously. I guess that's the best way to put it. I've never really said that out loud. But and then trying to get people to believe in what I was doing, that I could see this thing in my head, it was really challenging. A lot of people were very rude about it. And but I just kept plugging away, and finally I was just very, it was down to the wire. I mean, I'm talking a week or 2 weeks. I was about to lose my lease, and it finally came through. But, I wonder, if other people out there have similar experiences. This was my experience. It was, like, horrifying, and it was, like...
I think it's a lot like that.
I think the process... We've been there, done that.
I think living on the edge.
I mean, I'm sweating right now.
Living on the edge.
Yeah.
Fuck it. It's hot here. Oh, my God.
Yeah. I think this over and over and over. It's the same thing for everybody. I mean, it's different, obviously, the idiosyncrasies and the details and all that. But as far as this thing of doing your own thing, opening your own business, your own restaurant, whatever it is, without having capital, so you kind of got to go out and create your own everything, it's a process. And it is a similar, same process for everybody that is not guaranteed whatsoever. And it's extremely risky. You become vulnerable. You have to confront a lot of the fears of the unknown. You've never done it before. You kind of have to create the way,
Yeah.
It's hardcore. But when you do it, and when you become successful enough, whatever that means of doing it, the pride that you have or the confidence that you have won because of doing it is unparalleled because of what you've gone through. It's a proving to yourself of what you can do against all odds, and it's awesome. And
that's true.
It's fucking awesome that you've done this.
I didn't know I had quite that much grit
until girl, you do.
But I didn't realize I was quite that tough until it all.
Back in the day when we were hustling gelato for the restaurants and the wholesale, were the only one. You and Risk the cost. I can't even right now off the top of my head. I don't know of any other one that I would come across all the time in the restaurants or the farmers markets.
There was Marjorie. It was
but she wasn't here.
She
was not here yet. That's Graffiato Glory from that's kind of recent.
Anyway, I want to talk about Centralina a little bit, but I know we need to take a break. So let's take a 2-minute break. We're talking to Amy Brinewine, chef and owner of Centralina, 2-time James Beard nominee.
Can I say three?
I'm so sorry.
Tres. It's okay.
Tres. 3-time. That's my bad.
That's okay.
Even better. And we'll be back very soon to talk about Centralina and her new restaurant, Cafe Picolina. We're back at the Dolcezza Sherbert Experience. We're talking to Amy Brinewine, chef and owner of Centralina. And she was telling us how difficult it was to open her restaurant. And we're back in 2015. She finally opened Centralina. And it got amazing accolades, and a lot of things happened after that. And Centralina became the epicenter also for powerful, high-profile politicians to meet. And how did that happen?
I have some people that are involved in the business that are heavy into politics, so they would bring their friends over. I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of... female, I guess, senators, congressional members, they come because they want to support me. They like the food. And then the other thing is just we're in the middle of downtown, and, I think we hit upon sort of what people are looking for these days in a business lunch. You know, you can come in and just, like, be, like, completely, like, you don't have to be here there for a meeting, but and people come to the bar and like all kinds of people come in, but also people that are having meetings come in for a business lunch, and that, you know, we have a lot of fish. And so people don't want to eat heavy at lunch. So we have beautiful fish with vegetables and kind of things that are like easy to eat, meaning like it's not complicated. And so people feel relaxed and they have a good time. So they have their business meetings and they kind of have fun too. And a relaxed vibe, so people feel comfortable. So
you briefly mentioned when we started talking that you switched careers and you decided to cook. So you were in politics yourself,
yeah.
Right? That's what you did before cooking?
Yeah.
What exactly were you doing?
Well, I started out working for a law firm, Wiley Ryan Fielding. I was doing legislative affairs for them as a legislative aide. So, and I was also a legislative assistant. So I was like helping to file briefs, that kind of thing, and doing legal research. And I would go on the Hill and cover hearings. So I worked there. Then from there I went to Emily's List. This is a female PAC raising money for female candidates. And I was in the, believe it or not, I was in the compliance department, which is like the law and order department of these places. So like all the FEC laws, all the campaign contributions, processing all them, all the checks coming through, and making sure everything was compliant. My old boss, Anne-Marie Habershaw, unfortunately is no longer with us. She was the head of it, and she went on to work for President Obama, his campaign. And so I met a lot of people there, and I met my colleague who was sort of coaching me, Mary Jane Volk. She helped me kind of connect people. And then I just met people through people, and then so it ended up being a lot of political types, people that are involved in the restaurant, not because I wanted it to necessarily be a political restaurant. It just happened to be my network and who I knew. And
of
so,
course,
yeah.
That's where you came from.
Looking back, are you happy that you're in the kitchen now and not in the legislative world?
Yeah. You know, I'll tell you, the one thing that made me, it was like my final like kind of thought, like, I don't think this is going to work out for me. One of our clients was an insurance company, and I was heavy covering securities law, so banking laws, that kind of thing. So like my boss at the time asked me if I would, set up this fundraiser breakfast for just, I guess, a bunch of congressional staffers. And, you know, I don't know. I can't remember who else is going to be there. But it was like at 8 o'clock in the morning. And I was just having like anxiety about this because I was like, you know, I'm not a networker. I don't know how to conduct this event. I was freaking out. And, you know, I just decided like, you know, I might like the policy part of it, the research part of it, the writing part of it. I love to write. So I'm hoping eventually I can do some more of that somehow. But I was like, this networking part of it is giving me hives. Like, I can't deal with this. So, you know, I was like, this, if you cannot do that part of lobbying, then you can't do this.
That's what it's all about.
That's what it's all about.
Networking and
it's,
this and
it's
that.
It's talking to people.
Yeah,
and
it's all about
I love
networking.
Talking to people, but not in that way. So
it kind of still gives me heebie jeebies,
right?
Too, all that stuff. Because it's like, I know it's the necessary part of this.
Yeah.
But it doesn't come from a place of the inside. Like, I want to cook that because it's from this farmer and all that. And I try, it's a big effort, but. To move through the world doing what feels good in your heart and trying to do most of the stuff that you do from that place, you know, and not from the obligatory place of stuff
right.
that you have to do because it's required or expected of you.
Right. I felt like I should have been more excited. I should have been more motivated. I should have been more
engaging
with
world.
These things. Like, I should have been hugging this with all my might, because I was in, you know, I had worked for these powerhouse legislative affairs shops, so it wasn't like it was some rinky-dink place. It was like the name places. But I just couldn't get over that hump. And so I just said, this is, you know, I started cooking all the time. So I was like, you know, maybe this is the time. You know, you got to try to think about doing something else. So
going back to politics, how is working in politically polarized Washington, D.C.? I mean, how is working with, you know, Republicans and Democrats coming to your restaurant to eat, and you personally being so vocal about women's rights, coming from a political family, a political background?
Yeah, it feels pretty good. I mean, I think there's a lot of Democrats and Republicans that come in. There's some Republicans that are named people that are in the press every single day, very controversial, that come into the restaurant. And I really think that, you know, I'm there to feed people. And unless a customer does something that is harmful to another customer or my employees, then I feel like I should be open-minded to serving them. And, you know, I've really had no problems with, you know, kind of like these really crazy things that have happened in restaurants. I think it's important. I expect everybody to respect my political views. Like, I run a restaurant, I own a restaurant, so I should be able to speak my mind, because this is the United States of America, so I should be able to speak freely. And so I expect that I'm going to speak freely, like, and speak politely, with some thought. And I expect that everybody who comes in the restaurant of both parties, even like the crazy, like, you know, right wingers, like, I hope they respect that this is just my opinion, and I respect everybody else's.
The diplomacy of food also, there's something about that, like, yeah, getting down and sitting at a table and there's amazing food at, yeah, that table, that automatically kind of deflates a little bit of the differences in opposition and brings people together.
Yeah,
and
no, you're correct. You know, that's completely correct. Like, you know, like, when you cook something for somebody, you know, and they enjoy it, there's nothing more important than creating something for somebody to eat that is literally going to go down their throat and into their stomach. There's nothing more personal than that. You know,
survival, right. You have to eat to live.
And there's this, like, comforting part of it, and you're reaching somebody somehow. And yeah, so, like, if the people are coming in and I'm reaching them somehow, they feel comfortable, then I, quite frankly, like, that's enough for me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I think that's important, because the thing is this, is like, and the thing that we seem to be struggling with today is that conversation of opposing views. And that, to have opposing views is great.
Yeah.
If everybody had the same view, it would suck. It would be so mono, everything.
Agree with you.
So it's like,
yeah,
the fact that there are freaks and artists and lobbyists and suits and all of this, you know,
right wingers,
right?
Right wingers, left wingers, all of them. I mean, that's the thing that makes this whole world and our life, diversity, the best.
Right.
And it seems like right now there's this force or there's this tide of demonizing that with our view of this and our view of that. And I think it's very important to have a space where you can go and have opposing views and be okay with that. I think that's so important for the, like, survival of the species kind of level.
Yeah, I mean, I have one customer who's amazing. And he's incredible. He picked up on, you know, this restaurant that I actually was inspired by in Rome that I based Centralina on. And he literally picked it up out of his brain that it was his, like, favorite place in Rome, and have you been there? And I was like, oh my gosh. And he is very, 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 very conservative Republican. And, you know, is involved in some political things that I definitely am not for, but at the same time, like, he's one of my favorite customers, you know? And, it's just like, we have to be human beings, right?
Yeah.
We're all human beings. And, like, you're not going to have everybody in the United States of America be the same. Like, if you go out to the Midwest, people are not like me.
Right.
They don't have the same opinions that I do. Like, you know, and it just, we're all different, you know, but somehow, like, I mean, policy's made by many different people.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like all made by one person. Like,
right. Right. Or that would be crazy. A dictatorship.
Right, that
you know?
And that's like, and that's that what we're trying to stay away from is a dictatorship.
Yeah, there is a like I said, there's a rising tide on this planet, not just in United States of America and Washington, D.C. There is this movement right now. There's this swell of that. It's interesting to see how all of this stuff will play out kind of with the new tools that we have as a people with internet and smart devices and social media. That's something that we've never really seen play out before with those tools. So
Right. It's
really, you can feel the times that we're living in right now is very significantly charged. It's fascinating.
It is. I agree.
But that's awesome. So cool to hear that, like, there's this guy that has a super opposing views, very different from you, but it's one of your favorite customers, and hey, he picks up on where Centralina. That's awesome, because it's connection.
That's what
humanizes that whole thing, because you turn on the TV and it seems to want to dehumanize it, and it's us against them. That's not the case at all, because we all have something in common, no matter what those political, philosophical, religious views are. Below all of that, we're all human, and we all want the same.
Right.
At a deeper level, below the cultural level.
Right, I agree.
That's cool.
So, going back to food. I just want to...
You like doing that. I've noticed on this show, it's like everything that I say, you kind of look at me like, well, we're going back to my little chart, my script that I have. But that's what I'm here for, to kind of take you away from that script.
I love your opinion. I agree. We all suffer.
Let's go back to
Bialetta
on my right. Let's stay scripted in this business.
I want to make sure that Amy tells us about Picolina before we close the show. I want to hear about your new project.
Yeah, Picolina is a very small space, so it means like little one, you know, and it's right across the alley from Centralina, and it is just going to be a small eatery. We're going to be open for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, but like not really like, there'll be one all-day menu, so you can get eggs at night, or, you know, you just kind of mix it up a little bit. Wood-fired food. This very small space, I had one room for just like maybe one piece of a cooking equipment, and I had to do things fast, and I was, you know, how am I going to maximize flavor in a fast casual format? Because I didn't want to like do things in steam tables. It's just not how I work, you know. So I said, you know, let's get a wood-fired oven. I'm going to get it as big as humanly possible. We're going to cook omelets and crepes in the wood-fired oven.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so it's going to be
huge.
A
little bit of smoke on that.
Yeah, I'm just going to keep my cast iron pans in the oven, and then we're going to fire up an omelet in a hot pan and put it back in, flip it over, you know, that kind of thing. Baked bread is a new project for me. So we're going to bake our own bread, which is, you know... You know how people are so
well. You know who we were hanging out
bread.
With yesterday at our factory, Jonathan of Salu.
Oh,
so talk about like bread. Yeah, it's like that goes that. That's like the messiah of bread right now.
Oh, I know.
Hardcore.
I mean,
bread is amazing.
Fermentation.
And
it's very complicated though. So I'm just dipping my toe in it. But it's one of the things that I always wanted to learn how to do as a chef. And so when this came about, I said, this is it. It's a fast casual place. We're going to need sandwiches. We're going to need dough. This is your opportunity to do this. So it is a new thing for me, but I'm going to be able to spread my wings a little bit and stay in the same place, which is what Picolina is going to do is allow us to grow. And so, you know, there's a lot of demand for fast casual in that area. There's nowhere to get really, a sandwich or things like that. So, this will be a good thing.
I love sandwiches. I can't wait.
I do, but I don't like a lot of bread in between the sandwich. So we're going to try to keep it like digestible. That's my goal. I like a little bit of everything on my sandwich and a nice easy bite. So I'll see if I can get that done.
Yeah, that's
it's hard
to do your own bread. It's like that's what makes a sandwich.
Yeah,
it's like
sandwiches
what makes
are
the pizza,
not easy.
What makes the taco tortilla? You know, it's like that component is probably the most important part.
Probably,
of it.
And it's one of the hardest too.
Yeah,
I mean, constructing a good sandwich is extremely difficult.
Yeah. It's one of those things that seems easy, but it's not to get it right. Yeah, it's so
what
true.
Kind of bread you're going to use? What kind of sauce are you going to use? What kind of lettuce
the
are you going to use? Are you going to cut it? Are you not
going
to cut it? What about these tomatoes? You know, are they going to be mushy? Like, you know, how is this all going to work? You know, it's complicated.
Obsession, obsession, obsession.
I'm sure it's going to be amazing. In the kitchen. And I'm really looking forward to it. And thank you so much for coming and talking to us, Amy.
We wish you
the best. This is amazing. You guys are awesome.
Oh,
thank you. Keep rocking it.
Yeah. we can't wait to come by and have a good sandwich. And
all right.
Good bread.
An omelette.
Yeah. And an omelette.
Yeah. Awesome. You're awesome. Thanks for everything.
Thank you for being here.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
See ya.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook at Full Service Radio. Thanks for listening.